Happy Sabbath to all of you. It's good to be with you. My wife, who had visited with me here recently, she called me last night and wanted me to tell you hello from her. She's looking forward to coming out here. For those of you that are just new to the area, we're moving here from Arizona, and we're just in the midst of starting that transition. This week I'm going back to Phoenix and try to get things rolling in that direction, and be settling back here sometime in the very near future. A few announcements before the sermon. There's a number of different types of brochures like this in the announcement table area. If you want to avail yourself of them, feel free to. You can put them at various places of business where you might find that they could be taken, and people can then choose to subscribe or to receive some free literature from us. Many of you have the Prophetic Times emailed to you. It is produced by a pastor on the West Coast, Jim Tuck. And there's been so much going on in the news this week, I don't know how he kept it just to 2 pages. Maybe that's his cutoff point, 2 pages. But some of the articles that are in his Prophetic Times news update: Russia warns West against encouraging Middle East protests. Japan economy shrinks less than estimated. Gaddafi tells Palestinians revolt against Israel. There's one here: anti-government protests, clashes spread to Libya. There's so much unrest now around the Mediterranean that it bears a lot of watching. Turkey to help negotiate new roadmap for Iran nuclear program. Can you imagine? Turkey's going to help establish how Iran should run their nuclear program. It's not good. And there was a Saudi prince that called for reform amid regional unrest. There's a lot of unrest in the world. We even see it in our own nation. In Wisconsin, there's a lot of unrest because of they're going broke and they're trying to figure out how to solve the problem. And everybody just wants things for free as much as they can. Some of you that are new here, we do have, as I mentioned, an update form of communication. We have an email system that Barbara works and takes care of and updates. And if you want to keep up to date with anything happening in the congregation and some of these activities like the Prophetic Times, you can let her know. We shall put your name on her list. And then every so often, well, at least weekly, you'll be getting something from her. A final announcement here. For next week, February 26, we will have a service for the Sabbath in the city of Fellsmere, Florida. Those brethren living in that southern areas are invited to this service. Mr. Brady Veller is planning to speak there that day. There will still be a service next week in Miami as normal, but we're putting the northern location into schedule once a month for those living nearer to the Indian River County. We want to try that for a few weeks or a few months, just meeting once a month, and see how that maybe takes care of the needs we have there. On a personal note, I could let you know about some of the activities in the Caribbean area. I'm also the director of the Caribbean activities, and that's been ramping up, you might say. Once they found out that there was somebody that could help them, I've been getting quite a bit of communication and traffic from there. We have a church forming today in St. Kitts. We have a few brethren on Barbados. We have a majority of the people in Ocho Rios, Jamaica, forming a congregation and meeting today. They met last week. St. Kitts will have a pastor meeting with them on a one-time basis next week. And there's quite a few in Trinidad and Tobago that have an interest in the United Church of God, and that is going very well. I've already had information leaked out that we may have some Caribbean feast sites, and yes, we probably will. They're still in the formation, but it looks like we're going to have a feast in Jamaica at Ocorrios, and also one at Trinidad and Tobago. That one is very firmed up, and the other is being firmed up this coming week or the next, so we're looking for that. At this point, there just seems to be a lot of activity in southern Florida and on into the Caribbean, and I'm glad I can be part of it. Over in 2 Kings chapter 4, there's a story of Elisha and the Shunammite woman. I want to read some of this to you. Its application and the lessons you can learn are many, and certainly one of them is presented and even in the style of the sermonette today, that you can make sure you stay close to God in all times. But here we start with chapter 4, verse 8. It happened now on one day that Elisha went to Shunem, where there was a notable woman, and she persuaded him to eat some food. So it was, as often as he passed by, he would turn in there to eat some food. And she then said to her husband, "Look now, I know that this is a holy man of God who passes by us regularly. Let us make a small upper room on the wall, and let us put a bed for him there, and a table, and a chair, and a lampstand, so it will be that whenever he comes to see us, he can turn in there." So she was going to make him a little room. And it happened one day that he came there, and he turned in into the upper room and laid down. And he was rested, and he came to Gehazi, his servant, and says, "Call this Shunammite woman." And when he had called her, she stood, and he said to her, "Well, say now to her, 'Look, you have been very concerned for us with all this care. What can I do for you? Do you want me to speak on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army?' He says, 'I dwell among my own people. Everything's fine. What then is it I can be doing for her?' And Gehazi had an idea. He says, 'Actually, she has no son, and her husband is old.' So he said, 'Call her.' When he came, he says, 'Well, now I want to tell you something. About this time next year, you shall embrace a son.' And she says, 'No, my Lord, man of God, do not lie to your maidservant.' But the woman did conceive and bore a son, which the appointed time had come, on which Elisha had told her. Well, he grew, and it happened one day when he went out unto his father to the reapers. He said, 'My head, my head.' And they said, 'Carry him to his mother.' And when he brought him to his mother, he sat on her knees till noon and then died. Well, she went up and laid him on that bed of the man of God up in that little room and shut the door, and she went out." Now she wants to get Elisha to come to the house where the dead boy is, and I'm going to just move on to verse 32. The intervening verses are certainly good to read and worth reading, but I have a need to move on to verse 32. "And when Elisha came into the house, there was the child laying dead on his bed. And he went in there and shut the door behind the two of them and prayed to the Lord. And he went up and laid on the child and put his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his eyes, his hands on his hands. And he stretched himself out on the child. And the flesh of the child became warm. And he returned and walked back and forth in the house, again went up and did this again. And the child sneezed 7 times and then opened his eyes. And he called Gehazi and said, 'Call this Shunammite woman.' He, 'Pick up your son,' he said, 'Pick up your son.' So she went in, fell at his feet, and bowed to the ground, and then she picked up her son and went out." I think many of you are aware of that story. Let's turn now to a minor prophet, Habakkuk, or Habakkuk, as some of us will say. I'll give you a hint, it's on page 1135 in my Bible. It's one of those real small books, right after Nahum, then Habakkuk, one of the minor prophets in the beginnings of, at the ending of the Old Testament. Habakkuk. The burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see. And so I want to talk to you about Habakkuk. I want to talk to you about Habakkuk today. Now, why did I start in 2 Kings 4? Well, you remember that Shunammite woman, and she had a son, and your Bible says she embraced him. And then the second time after he dies, he's embraced by her again, and she carries him down from the upper room. Well, in Hebrew, to embrace is habak. If you embrace someone twice, it's habakek. The K's make it twice. Some people don't know who wrote Habakkuk, but the tradition is Habakkuk was the son of the Shunammite woman. Now, this bears on the story, because if it is that true, then you know why the rest of this book is so spiritually alive, and it's important for us to read it and understand it. It's a prophecy. It's in a series of 12 books called The Minor Prophets. But the rabbinical tradition speculates that Habakkuk was the son of this woman who lived in the days of Elisha. And as he starts to say now in verse 2, O Lord, how long shall I hear, and you will not cry, and you will not hear, even cry out unto you? Of all of the land, everything I see, and there was violence, and you don't stop, you don't save, you don't come in and help. See, he can reflect back to the fact that they told him the story. His conception and birth was a miracle, and that he was brought back to life as a miracle. And as he looks at all this, he knows his life was saved, and he says, as he looks around the sins of Israel, why aren't you saving Israel today? Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to behold grievance? For spoiling and violence are before me, and they are these that raise up and there's strife and contention. I think the last time I spoke with you, I mentioned how in Luke 21, one of the things to be aware of that was going to happen at the end time was there's going to be wars and commotion. And that word commotion is really a proper word to consider what's going on today. There's so much unrest, so much difficulty. People are concerned, they're stirred up, and they're not following leadership. There's a lot of commotion. And so in these verses, he goes on to say, when I look at your law, it's slack. Nobody considers the law. And judgment does never go forth. For the wicked compass about the righteous, therefore wrong judgment proceeds. He says, you want things to go right, but if you look around, everything is wrong. Now, the following verses are going to be the reply from our Creator, and He's going to explain why He is doing these things. And then in chapter 2, He says, I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower. And so He says, I'm going to go ahead and do my job. I'm Habakkuk, and I'm going to watch what you are doing, God. And so in chapter 2, verse 2, he's going to talk about, or the Lord's going to answer in what's going on. And then he's going to have five woes in this second chapter. Some terrible things that are happening. And we're going to come to verse 20, the last verse of that chapter. And when we finally get there, then you'll understand the context. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. Now, the reason that we need to understand this book is because it's what Habakkuk saw in Israel in his day. And he prophesied that Israel was going to fall, the house of Israel and the house of Judah. But this prophecy also applies as an end-time prophecy for our time. Because the Lord is going to return. And that's what this is important for us to understand today. And it goes back way to the thought of Elisha saying, you're going to have a son and you're going to embrace him. Now, God did embrace Israel before, and he brought them away from their captivity. And they were reinstituted, and their nation became strong once again. And we're going to find our nation, the nations of Israel, overrun and desecrated again. But God is going to embrace us again. He's going to embrace his people when he returns. So with that background, we see that in these first four verses of Habakkuk 1, this man is seeing all these problems around him and there's no solution. And here's what God then says about it. Behold, you're among the heathen. Look around and regard and wonder marvelously, for I will work a work in your days which you will not believe, though it be told you. Now, there is a verse that you can say has to do with the regeneration of Israel in the times of old and the setting up of Jerusalem. But also, it's something that we can apply in our time. There's a duality in this verse. I will work a work in your days, in our days. Which if we were told it, we would say, how strange, how difficult to us to assimilate. Because he says, I will raise up the Chaldeans. Now, Chaldea is an area. It's a place where people live, in Chaldea. The people who lived there were the Babylonians. And they were overcome by other people later, and one heathen nation after another lived in that fertile crescent area of Chaldea. But I'm going to raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. He says, you're going to be overrun, and you're going to see the nation overrun by Babylonians. And they're going to find themselves marauding through your whole countryside, taking what they want. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity shall proceed of themselves. Their horses are swifter than the leopards. They're more fierce than the evening wolves. Their horsemen shall spread themselves, and their horsemen shall come from afar. They shall fly as the eagle that is wanting to eat quickly. And they shall come all for violence. Their faces shall sup at the east wind, and they shall gather the captivity as the sand. And so they'll take into captivity thousands upon thousands, just as the sands of the seashore. And you go back into Genesis, and you can remark about how when God promised to Abraham that his children and his children's children would be as the sands of the seashore. Now, before we go on to verse 10, you might want to put a little thought into what we find in Ezekiel chapter 9. Ezekiel 9. here in verse 1, you find a similar mindset and perspective from Ezekiel that Habakkuk had. He cried also in my ears with a loud voice, saying, cause them that have charge over the city to draw near, even every man with his destroying weapon in his hand. Now that destroying weapon, I've seen them in a museum. I think there's only a handful of them still in existence. I've seen a replica and handled the replica. It's like a giant scythe, kind of like what you would find on the USSR logo where they had the hammer and the sickle. Well, it's that kind of a knife that they took into warfare. And it was meant to rip and cut through. It would be used to behead, to take off a limb, because it cut in a circular fashion and would move through whatever was being reaped. And you could reap grain and you could reap people with this ugly knife that was devised back then. And so he says, you have this destroying weapon in your hand. And behold, six men came from the way of the higher gate, which lies towards the north, and every man a slaughter weapon in his hand. And one man among them was clothed with linen, with a writer's inkhorn by his side. And they went in and stood beside the brazen altar. So here's a man that has a way to take a note. And the glory of the God of Israel was gone up from the cherub, whereas he was to the threshold of the house. And he called to the man clothed with linen, which had the writer's inkhorn by his side, and he said, the Lord said to you, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and cry for all the abominations that are done in the midst thereof. Habakkuk sighed and cried in the same way. He looked and he couldn't believe how much atrocity that was going on around him. He was shamed by the behavior of his people. He had been taught the ways of God more than likely then by Elijah. He knew these wonderful ways and what God promised, but when Habakkuk looked around, they weren't there. They weren't following godly principles. And the same with Ezekiel. When he looked around, his heart just sank. And he said, I sigh and I cry for what I see going around me. And to the others he said in my hearing, go you after him through the city and smite. Let not your eye spare, neither have you pity. Slay all the old and young, maids and little children and women, but come not near any man upon whom is the mark. And so the angel with the inkhorn was marking some. You should begin at my sanctuary. Now that's a troubling thought, really. But God says, I'm going to begin at my house where I am considered to be holy. Then they began at the ancient men which were before the house. And he said unto them, defile the house and fill the courts with the slain. So he says, the house of God is going to be filled with corpses. Go forth, and they went forth and slew the city. And it came to pass, while they were slaying them, I was left, and I fell upon my face and cried and said, ah, Lord God, will you destroy all the residue of Israel in your pouring out of your fury upon Jerusalem? Well, this is talking then about the end time when God is going to pour out the fury on Jerusalem and talk about the battle that happens in Megiddo and those terrible things that are prophesied to come in Revelation. He said to me, the iniquity of the house of Israel and Judah, and so all of them, is exceeding great. The land is full of blood and the city full of perverseness. For they say, the Lord has forsaken the earth and the Lord sees not. But the Lord has come to curse the earth. And then we find the blood rising as high as the horse's bridle, as it says in Revelation. And as for me also, my eye shall not spare, neither will I have pity. But I will recompense their way upon their head. Behold, the man clothed with linen, which had the inkhorn by his side, reported the matter, saying, I have done as you have commanded. Now, the writing of the names on the inkhorn, with the pen in the, at any rate, because there is a difference between people who know God's way and practice God's way, who sigh and cry for what is wrong, as compared to those who do such mischievous things and have forsaken all that is godly. Now, if you go back to Revelation 12, and this sermon can go into Revelation quite a few times, but I'm just going to look at three different scriptures with you. Revelation 12, 13. Just to remind you about people who have a mark upon them. And when the dragon saw that he was cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. And she was given two wings of a great eagle that she might go into the wilderness, be nourished for 3.5 times. Still Satan casts out a flood, an army, after them. He wants to be victorious, but the earth helped the woman. And the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood, the armies which the dragon cast out of his mouth. Well, then he tries to make war with a remnant of her seed. These are the ones, it says in the end of 17, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. You would think that God would take care and keep good note of those that are following His way. And if we go to chapter 14 of Revelation, perhaps just across the page, the first 8 verses have somewhat to do with this as well. It says in 1, and the Lamb stood on Mount Zion, with him 144,000. Now, time and again, people try to get exactly who is the 144,000, and you're more concerned with the number, when in fact we should be spending so much time being regarding of the ways of God. But they, 144,000, have the Father's name written in their foreheads. Interesting. So while we have a pen back there in Ezekiel 9 writing words, helping people to understand, we also find now that there are those whose foreheads have been marked who are keeping the commandments of God. And he says, a voice from heaven as the voice of many waters, as the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders. And no man could learn their song but the 144,000 who were redeemed, who were bought back, given back life, protected from the, and they were redeemed from the earth. Now, you can go on and read more about this in, well, maybe I'll just mention to you, going on in verse 4, they are they which are put are not defiled with women or false religions. They are virgins. They are they who follow the Lamb wherever He goes. They were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits of God unto the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. So this is a very important time to remember. There's going to be those who maintain a steadfastness and a practicing of God's way through any kind of difficulty. And it must be you and I, brethren, that are facing that and are solid in our foundation of following the ways of God. Moving to chapter 17, Revelation 17. And you can read how God then is going to make judgment verses 3 through 8. You can note verses starting verse 3. I'm going to just read verse 7 and 8. And the angel said unto me, "Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast which carries her, which hath the 7 heads and 10 horns. For the beast that you saw was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life." So you want to do a little study sometime during the week. Just look at the subject of the book of life in some kind of a concordance, or look it up, or just take your center margin, if you have a good center margin of reference in your Bible, and look at that book of life, that you want your name written in that book, and you want to be protected. Written from the foundation of the world, which when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. So there are some people like Ezekiel, like Habakkuk, who that sigh and cry for all the things that are going wrong, and that they want to see some changes happen. They want the return of Christ, and they will prove of their allegiance to the ways of God by their obedience. And that, again, must be you and me. So this attitude of sighing and crying and having a concern for what's going on is very important. It's how God marks your heart. Over in 2 Peter 2, 2 Peter 2, verses 7 through 10, there's some discussion here about Lot. And sometimes we look at Lot and the story of Lot and how his wife turned back and became a pillar of salt. Well, I want you to see the contrast here that you can draw from reading what Peter writes about Lot and Lot's wife. There's a contrast. I will start with verse 6. "And turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, he condemned them with an overthrow, making them an example unto those that that after should live ungodly." So if you live an ungodly way, God says, "I will destroy you." And he has done it before with fire. He will do it again and cleanse this entire globe. And we must be aware that that cleansing is going to take place, and that we're, using the word fire, on fire for the ways of God in our life and in our commitment and communication with God. "As in Sodom and Gomorrah, then being destroyed because they lived ungodly lives, yet he delivered just Lot," justified or obeying Lot, "vexed with the filthy conduct of the wicked, the lawless, the ungodly." I've added a few words there. Lot was just consumed with the same kind of attitude that Elijah had, that Ezekiel had, Habakkuk has, is prophesied in the end time, the 144,000 will have, just totally fed up and seeing what is wrong in how the society runs its life. "For that righteous man dwelling among them and seeing and hearing vexed his righteousness and his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds." It really bothered him to see what was going on in his midst. "And the Lord knowed how to deliver the ungodly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust to the day of judgment to be punished. But chiefly them that walk after the flesh in the lust of uncleanness and despise government. Presumptuous are they, self-willed. They are not afraid to speak evil of dignities." So it's important that we realize these points. Now when we look a little further then, Peter's description is really quite interesting. Lot was not tormented by demons or fiendish persecutors. It was what he saw and heard in the streets of Sodom and Gomorrah. Those perverse and depraved cities bothered him. He didn't find that that was a good way to live. He knew the inevitable consequences of sin and lawlessness, and he was aware that this was not the way to follow. And so it's good for you and I to make clear understanding that we know, and in our heart, there is a knowledge of the difference between right and wrong. It tells God something about our heart when we have a heart like Habakkuk, who just cannot contain himself like Lot had and sees all this trouble and disobedience around them. We need to be concerned, distressed, and repulsed by what we see around us. And then God will see that if we have that kind of an attitude, we would be suitable for Him to give us the kind of relief and protection from those things that are about to come. As I said in the last time I spoke with you in Luke 21, I believe it was verse 19, in your patience possess your very lives, your very souls. And it's a patient walk, but it is a distinct walk going forward. It's time that we take knowledge of this, for God is going to evaluate our character and what is in our heart. So as Ezekiel sighed and cried, I would encourage all of us to make sure that we are firmly entrenched in the ways of God. We have to ask ourselves, how do we react when we see what is going on in our nation? What is going on in the world at large? How do we react to the sex and the violence that we see on television, movies, and in magazines? Is it a temptation that we give into, or do we set the mark clear and don't go there with our minds and leave that alone? How do we react to terrorism, to drug use, to oppression? Do we have a godly view of these things? Our court system, it's a fouled up mess. It's a bribery-filled situation. So is politics. Money is what buys position. Do you see that, and are you understanding of what you would want God to do? Do we sigh and cry then over the depths of this nation's depravity? Going back to Habakkuk, we ended in chapter 1, verse 9. Now we go on with verse 10. And they shall scoff at the kings, and the princes shall they be a scorn unto them. They shall deride every stronghold, for they shall heap dust and take it. So the marauding armies are going to be absolutely in charge. Then shall his mind change, and he shall pass over and offend, imputing that his power is from his God. They'll say that the reason we have been given this is because our false gods, and you see it's a little g, is what has given us these strengths to overcome any of you. Are you not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We shall not die, O Lord. You have ordained them for judgment. And mighty God, you have established them for correction. You are of purer eyes than to behold evil. You cannot look on sin. Wherefore look you upon them that deal treacherously, and hold your tongue when the wicked devour the man that is more righteous than he. He makes men as the fishes of the sea, as the creeping things that have no ruler over them. They take up all of them with their angle, or with their hook, fish hook, and they gather them in their drag, or their drag net, their fishing. Therefore they rejoice and are glad. Therefore they sacrifice unto their net, burn incense unto their drag, because by them their portion is fat, and their meat plenteous. Shall they therefore empty their net, and not spare continually to slay the nations? So these marauding armies that are talked of in other places will ascribe their great god, false gods, as the ones that have given them everything, and they're going to just plumage and steal everything. Now in chapter 2, verse 1, as I said, there's this response back from Habakkuk. He says, well, I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower and will watch to see what he will say unto me and what I shall answer when I am reproved. He says he's not perfect, but he's going to maintain a look-see attitude and watch what is happening around the earth. So the Lord answered and said, write the vision, make it plain upon tables, that he may run that reads it. There's quite a few things in the Bible where it tells people to run, isn't it? To move away from bad situations and bad times. I got three scriptures down here where you could note these if you want to look at how what God says about running. One would be Matthew 24:14-18. There he says that when you see what is happening in Jerusalem, head for the hills, run to the mountains. Then there's Amos 3:3-8. Bad things happen. Something has caused it. And so there is an action that has caused that, and we need to run away from the wrong actions. Hebrews 12:1, it says, let us run with patience every race that is set before us. And so you have to run in the right direction and move yourself from the wrong direction when we are running. So when we look at this, the Lord answered and said, make it plain upon the tables, for the vision, verse 3, is yet for an appointed time. So there is a time when these things are going to happen. At the end it shall speak and not lie, though it tarry, will wait for it, because it will surely come, it will not tarry. It's going to make sure, you're going to know that it does come. Behold, the soul which is lifted up is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. Now, doing a little more study through the week, you can look at that verse. And what Habakkuk wrote, the just shall live by faith, and realize an important matter. Paul used that quote from Habakkuk three different times. If you read through the research that you can do, you'll see Paul used it three times. That shows that Paul was very aware of these scriptures that we're reading. And it puts a presence then in his mind when you read Paul that he knows what is prophesied to happen. So now we're at verse 5. Yea, also because of he transgresses by wine, he is a proud man, neither keeps at home, who enlarges his desire as hell, and is as dead and cannot be satisfied. He says, when you see this going on around you, people just taking what they want, but gather unto him all nations and heaps unto him all people, shall not all these take up a parable against him, a taunting proverb against him, and say, woe to him that increases that which is not his. And so here's the first woe. He says, you're going to look around, and one of the things you're going to see is people taking what they do not properly possess. They'll just steal it. And we see that so often in society today. We see people stealing things, stealing position, stealing people. So you say, how long will this continue? And to him that lays himself with thick clay, or him that works with clay makes bricks so that he can protect his position. Shall there not rise up suddenly, they shall bite, and that shall bite you, and awake that shall vex you, and they shall be for booties unto them. They'll take what they want, and you're just so much booty, kind of like a pirate. And they have again struck today. And in Somalia, there's four people, I believe they're U.S. citizens, have been taken off their yacht by Somali pirates. Because you have spoiled many nations, all the remnant of the people shall spoil you, because of men's blood and for the violence of the land of the city and of all that dwell therein. So there's violence all around. And then we come to the second woe in verse 9. Him that covets an evil with an evil covetousness to his house, that he may set his nest on high, that he might be delivered from the power of evil. You have consulted shame to your house by cutting off many people and have sinned against the soul. So abusing and just sometimes even killing people. For the stone shall cry out of the wall, and the beam out of the timber shall answer it. The walls will speak of the distasteful things that have happened. There's this attitude of covetousness that they just want everything. Then we come to the third woe in verse 12. Woe to them that build a town with blood and establishes a city by iniquity. Behold, is it not of the Lord of hosts that the people shall labor in the very fire, and the people shall weary themselves for very vanity? People have so much that they want to have, and they'll do anything to satisfy their vanities. And then we have a statement in verse 14 that is a peculiar placement in some minds. For the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as waters cover the sea. When is that? Is it the time of the return of Christ and the establishment of the kingdom here on earth? Central to God's mind is the establishment of His kingdom here on earth. That's His prime directive. That is what His focus is. What's it say? Seek first the kingdom of God and all these things shall be added to you. His primary purpose and everything that is here is bringing peace to this earth. And so this verse here, while it's peculiar to some, it shows that the only way that we're going to be delivered from the distasteful things that mankind does is by finding that the kingdom of God is placed here on earth. And that brings us to the fourth woe in verse 15. Woe to him that gives his neighbor drink and puts the bottle to him and makes him drunken also, that they may look on their nakedness. And so, getting drunk, getting undressed, they are filled with shame for glory. Drink you also, and let the foreskin be uncovered. Pretty plain language, isn't it? He says, what you do that should be covered, you're drunk and you make a fool of yourself, a spectacle. The cup of the Lord's righteous hand shall be turned unto you, and shameful spewing shall be on your glory. For the violence of Lebanon shall cover you, and the spoil of beasts which made them afraid because of men's blood, and for the violence of the land, of the city, and of all that dwell therein. So, what profit is it that you've had these graven images, these false gods that you're bowing to and praying to? The molten image. What good is a teacher of lies that the maker of his work trusts therein to make dumb idols? You think you've got it. Mankind thinks they have it made because they've made these idols. No, he says, woe to you. Say to the wood, awake to the dumb stone, arise, it shall teach. Behold, it is laid over with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all in the midst of it. So what the world has set up as far as false images is going to come to nothing. But we'll establish, we find in verse 20, but the Lord is in His holy temple, let all the earth keep silence before Him. And this, again, is a very important statement. It shows us that the prophecy is yet to come. That this is something that we're going to find when there is this stillness in heaven, because the great God is now in His sanctuary. And this then comes to the point of showing that there will be a time when everything that is corrupt will be destroyed and Christ will be on His throne in New Jerusalem. You know, the new heavens and the new earth that we find in Revelation 21. That is what this is talking about in verse 20. And so then we come to Habakkuk 2:20, and I wanted to read to you something I copied out in my notes from an old commentary written by a man I think of Scottish descent, named John Gills. This is what he says about that verse 20. Stand in awe of him and reverence him. Be subject to him and silently adore him. As all the inhabitants of the earth will when the above enemies of his are entirely removed out of it. There will be no more clamors and objections against the Christian religion by Jews and Mohammedans on account of image worship. They will be no more wars or rumors of wars, but a profound peace everywhere. No more persecutions of the saints. No more will be heard the cry of violence and oppression. All their enemies being destroyed, no more repining and murmurings among the people of God. Through impatience and unbelief, all afflictions being at an end, there'll be an entire silence of this kind everywhere. Only the voice of the gospel, prayer and praise and thanksgiving will be heard. This is not the case now, nor was there ever yet such a time on earth. This shows that the prophecy regards a time to come. That was written about 200 years ago. He could see that it prophesied a time to come. So then we come to chapter 3, the last chapter of Habakkuk. Any of you have a New King James Version that you're reading today? It's probably in a poetic stanza form. There are a few translations that acknowledge that Habakkuk 3 is a poem. Now, I'm going to bring up your childhood high school days. Remember when you had to read some poems that were difficult, like Homer's Odyssey? It's an epic poem. This poem in chapter 3 is on that same line. It is an epic poem. I'm going to read to you, in conclusion, from the Moffat translation. I'm going to read it in the poetic stanza that it is written in. Now, you follow along in your Bible, and you'll see these verses. But I think this will speak more clearly to your heart and understanding as I read it from the Moffat translation. And as I read it, those of us, as we've deeply studied the Bible and we know what's in Revelation about the seven seals, the seven trumpets, the seven plagues, and you've made a study of that. If you haven't, I'll do it with you some other time and show you those things and how they work together. But just listen as I read through this, and you see it in your Bible on your lap, that these end-time events are what is covered in Habakkuk 3. A prayer of the prophet Habakkuk in dithyrambic measure. We have heard you, O Eternal. We have seen you in action. Strike now, for the years are passing. Reveal yourself now as the years go by. Amid the wrath, remember to be merciful. God comes from Teman, the majestic one from the hills of Paran. His splendor over all the sky, his glory filling all the earth. His radiance is as a lightning blaze on either side, flashing rays. And there he veils his might. Before him, pestilence strides. Behind him, the burning plague. At his step, the earth is shaken, and at his look, nations are scattered. And the ancient hills are shattered. Mountains of old sink low, where he marched long ago. Scaring the tents of Cushan, shaking the curtained tents of Midian. Over the sea you stride with your steeds. The mighty waters surge. Art angry with the hills, O Eternal? Are you angry? Are you wrathful at the sea? that you are storming on your steeds upon the chariots in triumph. So your bow you bear, and the land is torn with streams. The hills writhe at your sight. Floods pour down from the skies. The torrents roar. The sun forgets to rise. The moon forgets to move. Before the flashes of your darting arrows, before the sheet of the lightning is your lance. You trampled earth in fury, threshing the peoples in your anger. You are abroad to rescue your own nation, to save your chosen. You have unroofed the enemy's house. You've laid it bare to the foundations. Your spears have pierced the warriors' chiefs who stormed out to scatter us. Their joy was to murder us, we poor folk in hiding. The sound of this sets our heart shaking. We listen with lips a quiver. Our very bones are breaking, and as we stand, we shiver. Yet calmly we await the day of doom that dawns upon the folk who would assail us. Though the fig tree may not blossom, though no fruit is on the vine, though the olive crop has failed, though the fields give us no food, though the folds have lost their flocks, and in the stalls no cattle lie, yet in the eternal we will find our joy. We will rejoice in you, God, who saves us. The Lord, your eternal, is our strength. He makes our feet sure as the feet of deer. Help us to keep our footing on the heights. From the choir master's collection to a stringed accompaniment. That's where it ends. So when we look at Habakkuk 3, and we see all that is going to happen, see in this book that it is a picture of what did happen before, and I really haven't given you much of that history lesson today, but it certainly is a prophecy for us to understand that is happening in the near future. There is too much commotion going on in our earth. Our nation is dying, and the world is dying. Every way possible, we see the destruction of all peoples. Now, some will paint a prettier picture than that, but that is the reality. And we, the people of God, need to maintain a heartiness for the ways of God and stand still to see the salvation of our great God.